You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of February 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. It turns out that all a senior official from the world's grimmest tyranny needs to do to get some good press in the West is turn up at a sporting event and wave. The curiously starstruck response to Kim Yo Jong. My guests Samira Shackle and Jonathan Fenby will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the plan to privatise the International Space Station. Is this the foundation of Trump Tower near Earth orbit? The remarkable life and incalculable legacy of Asma Jahangir. And will calling the National Front something other than the National Front make people forget that it's the National Front? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Samira Shackle, freelance journalist writing for The New Statesman, Guardian, Al Jazeera, Deutsche Welle, Monocle, etc. And Jonathan Fenby, former editor of the South China Morning Post, now chairman of China Research and director of European Political Research at T.S. Lombard. Welcome both. First of all Olympic host countries regard the Games as an opportunity to propagandise for their nation. The hosts of the current Winter Olympics, South Korea, are no exception. They may be vexed, however, by the degree to which their irksome neighbours to the north have gatecrashed the party. North Korea's cheer squad has garnered more international attention than most of the events, and no athlete has been so scrutinised as North Korea's senior-most guest, Kim Yo Jong, sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Jonathan, first of all, how big a deal is it that she's there? She is the first member of the Kim dynasty to have crossed the DMZ since the war.
Yes, exactly. And she's upstaged the nominal president of North Korea, who was also there but was rather forgotten about in the background. I think this is quite important because North Korea, you can say they were just trying out a gambit over the Olympics to get some kind of relationship with the South, above all to split the South and the United States. But they seem to have succeeded pretty well in this, given the reaction to it.
Well, that reaction, Samira, has it been untowardly fawning? There has been an awful lot of misty-eyed glop served by the world's media about Kim Jong-un's sister, who, lest we forget, does occupy a senior role in a thoroughly ghastly regime.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, I think, that the you could probably describe it as a kind of benevolent sexism, that the emphasis seems to be on her demeanour, on her smiles, on her facial expressions. There's a clip that went viral where she was allegedly giving a side eye to Mike Pence on her clothing choices, which were very simple, whatever. You know, all the kinds of things that I don't think you would have were she the first male member of the ruling family to go to South Korea. And that makes it very easy to kind of avoid the bigger questions about, you know, all the things we normally hear about North Korea, the gross human rights abuses, the whole nuclear war thing, all of that. So I think the fact that, that's the emphasis, I think, is shows that the kind of superficiality of this, and it's very gendered.
Jonathan, what have you made of North Korea's outreach in general? Because on the subject of it being very gendered, their celebrated cheerleading squad are, yes, of course, an exclusively female outfit, yep, although they did perform over the weekend wearing masks of a male figure who many South Koreans alleged, not implausibly, was in fact the face of a young Kim Il-sung.
It could have been, yes. I won't say iconic, because that's not a word you like, but a lot of iconic symbolism, messages being spread through this. But it's also interesting, the reaction in South Korea, while obviously, you know, the sister has dominated most international headlines, there are surveys in South Korea which show this hasn't necessarily gone down all that well there. The fact that some South Korean athletes who trained and qualified for the Olympics were suddenly thrown off the team to make
this is the United combined team, women's
the combined team, yes, to make room for the North Koreans. And there is, you know, still quite a strong right-wing nationalist streak in South Korea. And President Moon, his popularity is down, according to the polls, by 20% since he took office. That's mainly due to other things, it must be said, including the internal economy. You know, he now, Moon, has quite a difficult decision to make as to whether to accept the invitation to visit Pyongyang, what conditions to put to it. And then, of course, we've got the Washington Post today reporting that Mike Pence said, well, if they want to talk, we'll talk. What that means, I don't know.
We'll come back to that shortly. But Samira, on the subject of Vice President Pence, who you also mentioned in terms of, you know, getting apparently glared at somewhat by Kim Yo-jong, Vice President Pence, of course, declined to stand for the Unified Korea team. So apparently it's OK to protest at sporting events now. was that unnecessarily ill-mannered of him? Should he have got to his feet?
Yeah, I think it was a bit unnecessary. Apart from anything else, it's a huge kind of logistical effort on the part of the South Korean government, who are a US ally. So it's a quite kind of... it wouldn't have taken much, I think, to just acknowledge that. And I don't think it'll be particularly well-received amongst South Koreans. And it just shows, I think, again, a kind of pattern we've seen around the world of quite a sort of bullying, aggressive form of diplomacy, if you can call it that, but sort of making these types of statements, which, as you said, is quite ironic given their attitude to similar kinds of protests when directed against the Trump administration.
Is it possible, Jonathan, and this is a thing that I notice, or this it may be confirmation bias on my part, that I feel like I notice in all sorts of areas of modern life, that the effect that the Trump administration wants to have on a certain thing tends to be the more or less precise opposite to what the Trump administration actually wanted. Is it possible that both South Korea and North Korea have realized that they may have more in common with each other than either do at this point with an increasingly unreliable interlocutor?
Well, that's certainly what Kim in Pyongyang, young rocket man, hopes for, I think, that the inter-Korean dynamic, if you like, which he's tried to set going over the Olympics, that will actually be more powerful in South Korea than the, you know, we've got to stop the North getting nuclear weapons or missiles and so on. And then, of course, you get, where does Japan stand in this? And Pence went to Tokyo before he went to the Olympics and is very insistent that the Japanese are absolutely shoulder to shoulder, the golf-playing buddies, Abe and Trump, etc. But then you've got China, which will be, I think, very happy with the prospect for more inter Korean links and talks in the weeks ahead.
Samira, just generally, how miffed do you think the South Koreans might be about the fact that the North Koreans have rather waltzed off with the headlines so far, if not as yet any medals?
It's difficult to say, I guess. I think in terms of the long-term effect of this, while, you know, obviously there's been so much attention on Kim Yo-jong, I would be doubtful about how much store to set by it in the long term, because, you know, military exercises for the US and South Korea are going to resume in a couple of months, and that's hardly going to do anything to reduce tensions. So I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see any kind of immediate significant change in the relationship and in those kind of global dynamics.
Okay, well, let's move along now and look at the latest wheeze to emanate from the overworked what could possibly go wrong department of the Trump administration. Internal documents obtained by the Washington Post suggest that plans are afoot to turn the International Space Station into a privately funded operation. In the short term, this means only that editorial cartoonists around the world are at work at images of an orbiting casino adorned by a sculpture of a golden wig. But Jonathan, in the long term, and they're talking about defunding it in 2024, yeah. Is this necessarily a bad idea? Is there a base principled objection to the privatisation of space?
I don't think there's a principled objection to the involvement of private enterprises, private entrepreneurs, if that's where they want to spend all their money.
Well, we saw a spectacular demonstration of the possibilities of that last week,
Mr. Musk. Yes, and so on and so on. On the other hand, I would be pretty worried about the withdrawal completely of the state, the government, if you like, in this area, and just to leave it entirely to private enterprise. I think, you know, the potential for things going wrong, for people getting into it for nefarious reasons of whatever kind it may be, are just too high.
Samira, what does it tell us about this idea that even Senator Ted Cruz is opposed to this? And actually, because I find myself in, I think, the frankly unprecedented position of agreeing with him, I'm going to quote what he said, which was, as a fiscal conservative, you know one of the dumbest things you can do is cancel programs after billions in investment when there's still serious usable life ahead. Samira, does Senator Ted Cruz have a point?
Pains me to say he does.
Yes, I think we're all going to say we find ourselves in agreement with Cruz here.
Yeah, I mean, it seems very short-sighted, and I thought it was interesting that he's defending it from the position of fiscal conservatism, because, you know, obviously they've put this huge investment in it of about $100 billion, and to sort of farm that out before getting any kind of benefit back from that or return on that investment just seems, I mean, it just on the kind of base, like even on its own kind of capitalistic terms of opening it all up completely to private enterprise, that doesn't make any sense. And of course, you know, as Jonathan says, private enterprise isn't necessarily out of bounds here. There's already private companies involved with things like cargo supply and so on. But if you don't have any kind of state involvement, it just, I think an astronaut, was it Mark Kelly, I think his name was, who said last week that it would cause a complete halt in the lots of the kind of scientific aspects of this, of the low Earth orbit investigations and so on. So I think there's definitely There's no kind of clear reason why any private companies would want to take it over at the moment, or which companies they'd be. But yeah.
And there's also the whole question about a lot of intergovernment, interstate agreements about space and so on, and how private companies fit into that.
Of course,
if there's not going to be any government involvement, seems to me rather you know difficult to see. I mean, you can. You know, you can say, private enterprise, if it comes in, will take some of the burden, the financial burden, from the federal budget, which Trump is sending over a budget with tax cuts and infrastructure spending in other ways. But I think it's going to be pretty marginal.
Jonathan, this thing does apparently cost in the vicinity of $3 billion a year to keep operational, which is obviously not small change. But am I alone at this table in thinking that not nearly enough money gets spent on space exploration?
I've myself, and I may be alone at this table, have always been a little bit leery about the wonders of space and the wonders of going to the moon.
There is no pleasing.
I know there's no pleasing. I mean, I don't believe that the whole moon walk was all done in a studio somewhere in Hollywood, you know.
Good.
And obviously some governments do think it's very important. I mean, the Chinese see space as an area which, like the South China Sea, they can move into and make themselves number one there. I'm not sure that the benefits are. I mean, it's very nice, it's very exciting, it's very adventurous, and so on. But what the concrete benefits are, I'm not.
But the concrete benefits, Samira, are they not that it is exciting and adventurous?
But
and
actually, you might be in agreement with Donald Trump there, because I think he actually had said that he wanted to focus on putting people on the moon rather than the kind of boring low Earth orbit stuff, which this International Space Station focuses on.
That rather depends on which people he wants to put on the moon. I have some ideas on that front. I've agreed with Ted Cruz and Donald Trump in a matter of minutes. But seriously though, Samira, NASA's current occupants of the US federal budget, if that's even a word, and I'm sure it's not, is 0.5%. That is beans, is it not? Well, I mean, obviously 0.5% of the federal budget of the United States is not beans, but nonetheless, relatively.
Well, I think in terms of what they want to do, if what the Trump administration wants to do is, as it's been suggested or speculated, is more deep space exploration, then it's probably not enough money. Because, I mean, that's expensive to do. It's kind of very scientifically complicated and logistically and technologically and all of those things. But in terms of the kind of validity of spending that, I'm probably a bit more with Jonathan. I mean, it's difficult to, I don't know, it's difficult to say, isn't it?
It's difficult to say, and I don't want to seem like, you know, the down-to-earth, boring, unromantic
literally
person around this table, down-to-earth, literally. But, I mean, if I was crude, I'd say I think American infrastructure needs a lot more, is a lot more deserving and important to spend money on that rather than on some, you know, flying up in the sky stuff.
Absolutely no pleasing some people. On that note, we are going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Samira Shackle and Jonathan Fenby. Coming up next, remembering Asma Jahangir.
The First Monocle of 2018 is a media special, which takes us into the parallel worlds of music, movies, TV, technology, and, of course, print. We sit down with Takeshi Idezawa, the CEO of Japanese messaging app LINE, and get to know the cast of oddball characters who have helped him and his company conquer Asia. We head to LA for an expo that goes behind the scenes at the studios producing that most enduring and best-loved format in American television, the game show. From The Price is Right to Wheel of Fortune, we discover what lies behind the undying popularity of such programs. Then it's off to Indonesia to meet the team that publishes Compass, the leading Catholic-owned newspaper in a country where over 85% of the population is Muslim. And finally, in the design section, we take a tour around the former Berlin broadcasting house that's been converted into a slick new arts hub. The Monocle February issue is out now. Get your media fix and pick up your copy today, or subscribe at monocle.com.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Jonathan Fenby. Now, the life of a human rights campaigner is never an easy option. However, a greater degree of difficulty is attached in Pakistan than in most countries. This never deterred the lawyer and activist Asma Jahangir, who died this past weekend, aged 66. At various points in her long career as a champion of women's rights and other tenets of elementary decency, she was imprisoned, placed under house arrest, and the subject of an assassination plot by officers of Pakistan's intelligence service. One of her many admirers, the Nobel Peace Laureate Malala Yousafzai, called her a saviour of democracy and human rights. Samira, within Pakistan, how important a figure was she?
Hugely. She was a kind of household name, and she had made herself into a household name through the defence of some of the most marginalised people. And she just, her kind of career was a roll call of pretty extraordinary things, quite quietly extraordinary sometimes. But she and her sister set up the first law firm in Pakistan to be run entirely by women. It was also the first free legal aid centre in a country where there's very little state support. They primarily represented women who are too poor to pay for legal support. That was often battered women or so on, people who are very marginalised and at that stage had very little legal protection in the legal framework of Pakistan. She also presented people who were trapped in bonded labour. That was one of her first kind of big cases, people who would be trapped in the brickmaking industry in particular, sort of trapped in a modern slavery situation. So a whole series of things defending very, very marginalised people. She also took on blasphemy cases, which is extraordinarily dangerous in the context of Pakistan, where people often are killed in mob violence when they're accused of blasphemy. And in addition to that, sort of set up the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, so really championed that whole concept of human rights. She stood up to the religious establishment, to the military establishment, and she's been described in numerous Pakistani newspapers since her death as Pakistan's bravest citizen, which I think is actually probably quite accurate in this case.
You may just have answered this question as well with that extemporization of her life and works, but why was she perceived as such a threat?
I think because she was very unafraid about saying things. There's quite a famous clip of her at an anti-military protest. So she's sort of facing up to, she was a very small woman in stature, facing up to soldiers and just saying, come on then, shoot me. She was very, very unafraid. She refused to leave the country despite threats to her life, which many other activists are kind of forced to do. They end up kind of in self-imposed exile and agitating from there. She quite explicitly said that she had no intention of doing that. And also because she was effective. I mean, she won some really high-profile cases with instances, say, of women being gang-raped and taking accusers to justice, winning legal concessions for these bonded labourers and so on. So she was very, very effective. And her Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, which she co-founded, the annual report that they produce is still a kind of really, really important annual event in Pakistan that's a very powerful tool for holding the state to account.
Jonathan, what does it tell us about Pakistan still in 2018 that the things that Asma Jahangir was campaigning for were things that actually needed to be campaigning for? Because a lot of it does sound like, well, a lot of it is pretty entry-level stuff.
It is, indeed. I mean, it tells you, I think, that the extent to which the various competing power groups and so on all actually play along with a system without wishing to change it, and the importance, in her case, of having people who stand up, who stand outside the power system, but can speak truth to power, if you like, there. And that is something which, as I gather, in Pakistan is all too rare.
Samira, is there cause for encouragement, though, in the fact that what's interesting about her as an activist, and as you point out, it was she took considerable risks, you know, with her own, you know, her own life and safety to do what she was doing, but it's such a strange morass of contradictions, Pakistan, in that all that stuff that she's campaigning for needs to be campaigned for, but her weapon was the law. It wasn't that she was having to operate outside it in order to get things done. She actually used the fact that Pakistan is theoretically, at least, a nation of laws.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that was and some of those causes that I've outlined, I should be clear, with kind of going way back, things that she advocated for in the 70s and 80s, which created or kind of improved legal frameworks that have vastly improved the situation for people today. But she, I think what's interesting, it was through the law, but she also pushed the other side of it, because what you often have in Pakistan, as in many countries where there are weak state institutions, is that there can be quite good laws for protecting, say, women or religious minorities or whatever it is. But when you have a very fragile and weak state, those laws are often not enforced. And what she was quite tireless about was defending the kind of people at the sharp end of it and using those laws that were there to try and defend them, or when they weren't there, getting them improved. But she didn't just focus on the kind of statute book aspect of it. It was also about the implementation and drawing attention to the places where that implementation failed.
Jonathan, as a general rule, not just in the case of Asma Jahangir, but when somebody of her stature and somebody who's done the sort of work she does dies, how important and difficult is it to keep their legacy out of the clutches of those that she was campaigning against? There's been endless official tributes from current and, you know, former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. The current Prime Minister Shahid Abbasi called her a brave voice for the voiceless. There have been calls in some quarters for a state funeral. How important is it that she doesn't get co-opted?
Very important, I would have said, because the danger of, you know, the opponent, not the sole voice, but the kind of voice that we've heard about, dying and then being, as you say, smothered almost, and the memory being smothered and what she was trying to do being smothered by official, quote, acceptance, unquote, is always very considerable. And it's a question of keeping the legacy. And I don't know. I mean, who is there to maintain this legacy?
Who is there? I mean, there's lots of people who are kind of very, very hardworking and brave human rights advocates and lawyers. And I mean, there's pretty sizable civil society in Pakistan, and people often working at huge personal risk. But I think what was unusual about Asma Jahangir was that she was so unashamedly kind of pro-secular, pro-liberal, all of those things, and she felt no need to kowtow to the kind of religious establishment or the military establishment in the way that lots of other people do for their own safety. Her attitude was a kind of two fingers up to all of that, and I don't know who exactly will replace her in that respect.
And also, she got results from what you said. I mean, that is also very important. And you can be for the right thing, but if you don't actually get something done, then it tends to reduce your credibility.
Yeah. Well, finally tonight, to France, where Marine Le Pen, leader of the far-right National Front, has reasserted her commitment to using next month's Party Congress to change the party's name, which she apparently fears has become irrecoverably associated with racist crankery. She might then want to take a look at the name Le Pen. She has not as yet offered any indication as to what the party's new name might be, but has declared that the National Front is not renouncing anything. We are starting a new chapter in our history. I have some ideas for new names for the National Front. I don't think she'd like any of them. Jonathan, can you rebrand a political party?
It's very difficult too. And I mean, she also wants to get rid, really, of the memory of her father, which is difficult, given that they have the same name, and given that he seems to be absolutely intent on forcing his way into the party Congress and making as much trouble as possible.
Isn't he literally 300 years old?
He's pretty old. He's pretty old. I mean, he's older than I am. he goes back a long way. nothing puts him off. He's blustering his way back into the headlines. He's won a court case against the party, which had tried to exclude him, and so on. He has his position of honorary president, which he says, gives him the right to attend the Congress. And the answer to your question is, I don't think she can disassociate the front from its past, particularly since it's not doing very well at the moment.
On that subject, Samira, if you were advising Marine Le Pen, I'm sure you probably do have advice for her, which she'd probably be disinclined to take. But if you were thinking about the predicament she's in, and Jonathan points out that they're not doing very well from a purely strategic point of view, divorced from any principles or decency, doesn't make more sense if you're the National Front now to try and tack towards the centre and appear moderate and reasonable, or just go full swivel-eyed, foaming at the mouth, hang them, flog them, send them all back?
I don't know, really. I mean, I think that what she seems to be trying to do is to kind of find a bridge between those two options, and kind of really emphasising the immigration law and order stuff, but framing it in a very kind of reasonable way. So she's not saying explicitly racist things, perhaps. She's framing it as we need to think about the ethnic makeup of France and about the security concerns implicit with the sort of ethnic Frenchness being diluted and all of that. So I think it's quite dangerous in a way, because if you do go full swivel-eyed loon, as you've said, then that's much easier to condemn. So having that dog whistle there quite explicitly, but couching it in sort of moderate, reasonable language, which seems to be what she's trying to do, I think that's quite worrying.
But she did try, by her standards, being reasonable last year, and she lost.
Yeah, and she lost very badly, and it was kind of almost a personal loss, because I think everybody would agree that it was her performance against Macron in the last television debate that really was disastrous and brought her down. Mm. And this was meant to be the front's great chance. I mean, I myself, I don't want to be wise after the event, but I never thought that she was going to get more than about 35% of the vote. That is the front's natural ceiling. Her problem now is that the mainstream Republicans, mainstream right-wing party under its new leader, has tacked to a much harder right-wing position, precisely in order to win back its supporters who defected to the front. The front is also divided. Her lieutenant has left the party and is setting up his own movement. It doesn't know where it is, not just on immigration it knows where it is, but on Europe, on the whole Frexit idea and so on and so on, it doesn't know where it is. It is a deeply confused and troubled party, and I don't think a simple change of name is going to do much to help that.
I mean, with a party of the National Front's general inclination, Samira, is when they talk about rebranding or reorienting themselves, is basically what they're trying to do, trying to get that they're trying, aren't they, to give permission to people who don't like to think of themselves as cranky racists, but who kind of are, to vote for the National Front?
Yeah, exactly. You see this all over kind of Western democracies, don't you? The idea that we have lots of racism but no racists. people don't want to self-identify or see themselves in that way. So perhaps she wants to make it more acceptable to vote for her party. She's aware of the stigma and of that ceiling that Jonathan's mentioned, that ceiling of a certain percentage that it's very hard for them to get above. I think that just renaming the party is going to be, I mean, I'd be surprised if that has that much effect, because people aren't stupid. As you said in your intro to this story, that Le Pen itself is a name that's pretty strongly associated with a particular set of views on race and immigration, and they're not necessarily the mainstream ones, at least I hope they're not. So I think just a new name without a wholesale rebrand, I'd be surprised to see if it makes a difference.
And she also has the difficulty that the kind of the angry vote, if you like, which was among the unemployed, among industrial workers and so on, which really had fueled the National Front over the last few years, that's now been captured by the hard left, Mélenchon, and so on and so on. So there's really hardly anywhere for her to go, and she'll be left to fight it out with her father.
Well, we look forward to that. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Samira Shackle and Jonathan Fenby, thanks for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, researched by Louis Harnett O'Mara. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music next at 1900, it's Culture with Rob Bound. The Daily has more on the day's main stories at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening.